begin with a prayer. Manna and mercy all over the place. Help us to see, Lord, your presence in others, in your word, in your creation, and in us through Jesus the Christ, so that we may receive the manna, celebrate the mercy, and share, so that your rule of love will soon come among us as it truly is in heaven. Through that same Jesus. Amen. I have to ask if, it's time to begin. This is Elmer Witt. I'm hearing those people on our second session on manna and mercy. That is entitled A Theological Coloring Book. And tonight we're talking about a theme that ends up by the waters, is the rivers of Babylon. I can look it up. By the waters of Babylon. That's number two in the series. This is Wednesday evening. So we get started. How many of you were not here, not at last evening's session? All right. Well, do we have excuses or something?
You weren't here. You were not here.
Sure, that's usual.
I didn't know how good it was till we talked to the people.
Ah. We were going to be here, but we ran into his cousin that we didn't know was his cousin.
All right. Well, what I'm doing is talking about this book called Manna and Mercy, hot off the press. I think it arrived at, it's printed down in Albuquerque. I think it arrived at Dan's house early last week. So it's pretty new. He'd been working on it, I think I said last night, 400 years. It may have been only 300, but for quite a while. And it's a book that he put together entirely by himself. He's an artist as well as a theologian. He does all the printing and the artwork as well. And he ends up himself calling it a theological coloring book. And in front, he even suggests that you color the things in, which I've been doing instead of studying. The crayons up. It's written by Dan Erlander, who is, I said last evening, and I'm willing to repeat it, that I think one of the most favorite teachers at Holden Village, comes up here frequently, has lived here longer periods of time too. He was born of all places in Wyoming. And most people never guess anybody being born in Wyoming. I don't know. He said, what state do you think I was born in? And his dad was a parish pastor. His dad is still living in Tacoma. Dan now lives in Parkland, right near Tacoma, and is a part of a team that three people who are the campus pastors at Pacific Lutheran University. Susan Briel and Martin Wells and Dan share two positions, and so they each work part of a week that way. He had been in the parish before and had in three different places and had lived and taught at Holden Village as well. He had two other books similar to these in layout, Baptized We Live and Justified by Faith. Baptized We Live, I said last night, is sold in the thousands and is used all over the country. I think copies of it, I know, are in the library and certainly over in the bookstore. And I said one of the unusual things about Dan is that he thinks pictures and has to translate his pictures into words. So he comes at things a little differently. Then we said it last night, I said last night, you didn't necessarily say it, I didn't know whether you agreed or not, and that is that we start out with an old story. And for some people that means stale, and outmoded and long ago, rather than vintage or experienced or valuable. And so the way we tell that story, how we let that story, enable that story to get to be live and fresh and new, is one of the things we always struggle with. If you keep repeating the same thing all the time, it's very possible people tire of it and turn it off. Dan is one of the person who helps us think about those same treasured vintage things in new ways. And I'm really glad about that. He calls it the story of God, which is, you know, a broad enough perspective for the book to be able to include, I'm sure, everything. And we went through the first four chapters of the book last night that talk about the beginnings of the world. He talks about the earth as a speck in the universe, revolving around an absolutely unknown star in the big cosmic picture, and that the Creator decides to do something special with that speck and makes it possible for life, with all of what that may mean, for plants and animals, and then for humans, humus, people of the soil, people of the earth, to live here and to work out a way of being in God's creation that is what God had in mind. Or to put it another way, as Dan does, God's dream of how it could be. And the story begins with God putting that in shape, and then the people getting out of line with it, working out to be big deals instead of living generously and harmoniously with one another and with the creation and with the animals and nature. They begin killing one another. And God, of course, gets terribly upset, considers destroying the earth, considers scaring the daylights out of the earth, terrorizing the earth, but decides you can't destroy your child. And said he's going to mend the universe. And it's that story of mending that Dan starts with. And it starts basically in Egypt, where the people of Israel, God's people, are being oppressed. And we talked about I'll put it down again because it comes in again today. In Egypt, the setup was like this, that the Pharaoh was on top, and the Pharaoh's family was next, and the government leaders were next, and the special people, big deals, were next. And then finally down here were the ordinary people who did all the ordinary job, and finally down here were the slaves. And above was an image of a God that said, this is my guy, and this is the way things work. And so each person pushed the other person down and got stuff that they could out of the people below them. So he was getting something from everybody, and he were getting somebody from the rest and all that. And so the Pharaoh and the big deals were stacking all the stuff that they had. And on this side and on this side were people saying that this is the way it works. This was the military that says we can't afford to let any of these people to get out of line because the Pharaoh is in charge. And the religionists who said, this is God's plan, the way things ought to be. And that was the way, the opposite of what God wanted to happen. And so to get them out from under that and get them to have a chance to live something the opposite of that is what God did in the Exodus in taking the people out of Egypt. And Dan points out very strongly, as many people do, of course, that the Exodus is a lens through which you look at the whole Hebrew Scriptures. That's the focal point. And that helps you understand everything in all of the books of the Hebrew Scriptures, if you see it through that, because that's the thing that they kept going back to. That's the story that they kept telling about themselves. Remember that. Even had the Passover as the reminder of that event. And then I said at the end of the class last night, Dan does the same thing in the New Testament when we get there, to say that the suffering, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ is the lens through which you see the whole of the New Testament as well. And that gives you the understanding of all that else that's going on. You see that through the eyes of Jesus Christ. Why Paul could say, I know nothing among you save Jesus Christ and him crucified. The lens through which you look at. Well, the people escape from that land, and then they are led out into the wilderness, and Dan calls that the wilderness school, where the people are taught how to live in that new way. And how does God teach them? God, and again, I'm quoting lots of Dan's words. In Dan's words, he waits for the teachable moment when the people complain about food, and he sends them manna. And manna just means, what is it? Because they didn't know what it was. Some edible substance that was good. But the way God taught them through that was, God gives manna for all. Secondly, that hoarding manna stinks because the stuff rotted. And thirdly, the gift of the Sabbath came with the manna. So God provided manna each day, taught the people all food is God's. People gathered the manna. They had to go out and get it. It didn't drop into their mouths. So work was approved in this process. And God gives food enough daily for everyone. The larger clans gathered more. The smaller clans gathered less. But everybody had enough. And when some people started hoarding the manna, it began to stink. And the Pharaoh Egypt way of stacking up stuff for yourself is not the way the manna people are to live, because hoarding brings decay and rot and death. In lesson three, the gift of the Sabbath, no manna fell on the seventh day of the week. Enough manna fell on the sixth day for the sixth and the seventh, and it didn't rot. So humans do not have to work every day to receive and distribute God's manna. The extra time is a beautiful gift of God, which makes it possible for humans and animals and the earth to rest. And so God gives that kind of rest to people, part of God's design. The way God dreams about people living in the world that he has created. So it's friendship with God, friendship with others, and friendship with nature that God is after, dreaming of a universal manna society. And then along with that, we talked briefly about the covenant that God gives. It's a big celebration, and when they receive the commandments, and I think my memory of this always was that it was a pretty tough time, and God was chewing them out and everything. And Dan points out the scriptures makes that much more of a celebration, because God binds God's own self to the people of Israel. He says, I'm going to be with you and stick with you. That's the covenant. And then gives these commandments on the two tablets as a way of explaining how you can live in that kind of covenant so you won't wreck the covenant. And then the dream is that they will follow in that way, and the people give thanks for the covenant, and especially then for this Sabbath rest. And then Dan points out again clearly the Sabbath day, the seventh day of the week, the Sabbath year, the every seventh year, and the Jubilee year, the 50th year, the grand sabbatical year. On the Sabbath day, the partner people rest. The Sabbath years, joyful things happen. Work animals get rest. The people rest. There's abundant food for all. Debts are canceled to keep this Pharaoh thing from happening. In the Jubilee year, all land lost because of debt or misfortune goes back to the original inheritor. Again, God's way of assuring that this society, his manna people, won't end up in that way again. And he gives them an understanding of righteousness and mercy. Follow the covenant. Live God's way. Mercy, compassion towards those who cannot live that way or who are not in the covenant people. So they have righteousness and mercy as their pattern. And the gift of worship is giving them so they can respond to the gods whose design is and whose vision and dream is a people that lives together in peace. Then, in the next chapter, in 5, Dan calls this the graduation and settling down. They're taught in the wilderness school. Now they get up to the river to cross over into the promised land. That's graduation time. And the graduation speaker is Moses. And he lays out what Moses said at the graduation time. And when you follow the way of righteousness and mercy, you will bring blessing and happiness to yourselves and your society. You will choose life, and you and your children will live. When you do not follow the way of righteousness and mercy, you will bring sadness and curse to yourselves and to your society, and your society will rot and smell foul like the hoarded manna in the wilderness. And then he gives them their diplomas, and he gets up to Mount Nebo to take a peek at the land, and then they go in. Joshua helps conquer the land. In many places, some of the people joined with them, were collaborators in getting the land, and then they joined from the Palestinian cities. They joined the children of Israel afterwards. And then they were taught, and this is often, I think, missed by us, and I like the way Dan brought it out, that the gift of land was like the gift of manna. They were given land in the way they had been given manna. And they should treat land as they had treated manna. That it wasn't for them to store up and make lots of stuff. So again, somebody's on top telling who gets what all around and pushing people around and whatever it may be. But that the land, like the manna, was not for hoarding, but for everybody to have some and for everybody to enjoy the land. And for people to share of the land with one another. And the partner people get together at Shechem and work out a partner, their own covenant relationship in the land, and God is pleased. In early Israel, there were good days, not perfect days. The people lived on their land, their inheritance, and fair amount of simplicity and equality. They didn't neglect the widows and the orphans, which was one of the things that God's plan was about. Sometimes, however, they forgot both Yahweh and the covenant gift and began worshiping the gods of their neighbors. And then the society would rot, and the neighboring people would take advantage of them. And God would raise up individuals that Dan calls the liberators. These were the judges of the old time. Temporary leaders who would unite the people in time of crisis like this. Liberators could come from any one of the clans. It could be women or men. The only requirement is that they would bring the Spirit of God. And they understood that they were temporary liberators. They weren't people who were headed to be back up here and run the country or something like that. They just helped in the time of crisis. So during all this early Israel time, no big deal oppressed class emerged. People still had enough, and no one had too much. And Yahweh said, there's hope. There's hope. And then when they were true to God's vision during this time, they'd retell this story about, again, leaving the land of Egypt, the wonderful stories of their past. And, tell the one, he has pictures of little child saying, tell the one about Sarah's laughter again. And okay, once upon a time, Sarah, and then they tell the story of Sarah and Abraham. And they love the covenant stories of their ancestors, Rebekah and Isaac and Esau and his twin brother named heel grabber. Rachel and Leah both married heel grabbers, you remember. And so they became people of memory as well as people of hope. Their stories, being told again and again, were important to them. And that led them to be people of hope because they could, from those stories, were envisioning that dream that God had in mind. In chapter 6, he talks about we want a king. We want a king. During the early days, the early Israel, the people had this relative equality, but as this went on, they faced a vexing problem because their neighboring people kept bothering them, stealing from them, and attacking them. The situation led to a real heated debate within the community of Israel, one side saying, we want a king, and the other side saying, we don't want a king. And the two arguments went simply like this. We need a king to protect us from our enemies. We must live in the real world. We need not fear. The king will not oppress us because he will be one of us under God in the covenant. And I plead with you for the sake of our national security and the safety of our children, we must have a king. And the people on the other side said, and these are all quotes, he has loads of biblical quotations in here. You can follow them up anywhere. I think, in fact, next week or the week after, Verlon Brown is going to use this as a basis for a Bible study in the morning hours. If we have a kingdom, if we have a king, the other side said, we will become like other nations. We'll have military conscription. Elites will grab the land entrusted to our families. We'll become like slaves. We'll have to do hard labor for the king and his big deals. And the king will lay heavy tax burdens on us. We will cry out to God in the wilderness. And the pro-king realistic majority wins out. Samuel speaks on the side of not having a king. And he and Yahweh are in partnership in trying to have that not go in that direction. But finally the people persuade them and they agree that they can have a king. God and Samuel hoped it would work. And they first picked Saul, as you remember, and he didn't turn, society didn't turn into rich and poor, and big deals and little deals, but Saul had so many other problems as king that they went on and went to Jesse's house and picked David as king. And Yahweh loved David. By the way, Dan spent some time talking about why it's Yahweh. That was the gifted name that God gave to the people. It wasn't a incidental name. It was a precious name to the children of Israel. So Dan takes the precious name, keeps using it for God. Yahweh loved David, and David embraced the covenant gift, and he practiced righteousness and mercy. He sins grievously, as we know, but he cried for forgiveness, something that kings and presidents wouldn't do in the setup back in Egypt, and God forgave him. And so God promises that David and his descendants will rule forever and ever. So God pictured kings leading the manna people, practicing righteousness and mercy, and humbly recognizing the gentle rule of God. But God's hope does not work out. When Solomon succeeded David, the worst fears of the anti-king came true. Turning from the manna way, Solomon and his elites gather massive wealth for themselves. They imposed forced labor, heavy taxes, and God's partner people became a society of big deals and little deals, exploiters and the exploited. For a king, forsaking both righteousness and mercy, Solomon found glory in his 700 wives and 300 concubines. Count that up, that's 900. He's big. I don't think he was as bright as we say. His palace, his army, his piles of gold, silver, ivory, cedar, and fine clothes, and in his collection of apes and baboons. Look that up in 1 Kings 10. And Yahweh wept, and all creation wept, because Israel had become what Israel had left, Pharaoh's Egypt, once again. I'll just summarize these next two chapters, and I want to get you into some talking about this. I'd rather have your reactions to it, but I want to give you an idea what these next ones, just like four more pages, okay? Yahweh sends prophets is the next chapter. When Solomon died, things went from bad to worse because of Solomon's big deals and his unfair preference for the south, Judah area against the north of Israel. The northern tribes split away, formed their own nation, and God's partner people now split into two. And they're rival nations, each with their own king. And the people of both Judah and Israel increasingly left their true partner and leader, the liberator God. They moved away, and they worshiped the manna piles and the gods of their neighbors. And so the lines that are used here in the portions of scripture it comes from, they follow these other gods because these gods promise successful crops in exchange for correct ritual forms. If you do these things, I'll bless you. If you do these things, I'll bless you. Completely different from the manna god, who says, I give you everything you need in advance, before you do anything. Here they had a barter with God. And so more and more the rich exploited the poor, practicing neither righteousness nor mercy. And by bribery and cheating, the rich added house, this is the line, house to house and field to field. They even began to think they earned and deserved their own land and riches. Now the land looked like a place where the poor were pushed out, the little deals all laid aside, and the biggest deals had the biggest stuff and were surrounded by military to protect them. So the old vision faded, and they kept increasing. They didn't stop worshiping Yahweh, but they did it in terms of religious actions. As a way of manipulating the deity to get good fortune. We'll keep doing the same old stuff. And that's when Yahweh says to them, your religious rituals make me sick. Not because they were worshiping God, of course, but because they were doing it in order to get something from God, trying to manipulate God. So instead of seeing the manna as a gift, manna in the size of one manna's pile had become the reason for living. Get that? Instead of seeing manna or the land, both were God's gifts, as gift, they began seeing that as the reason for living, the opposite of what God's dream was all about. And then would the partner people ever remember Yahweh's promise? Well, all along, there's a small remnant that hangs on. And from that remnant, the prophets of Yahweh come. People like Amos and Hosea and Micah and Isaiah and Jeremiah. Through their words and action, their dramatic action, God pleads with the people of Israel to come back. And that's what these prophets are about. Come back to me. Come back to your true friend and partner. Come back to the covenant gift. Come back to your calling, to the lessons you learned in the wilderness. For I am merciful, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. And then the clever people that were running the kings, they had official prophets who would be alongside. The kings were bothered, these prophets. They'd go, let's get rid of them. How can we get rid of them? Well, we set up our own prophets. And they would say things that the people wanted to hear. Just like these people here, they would say all the things that kept this stuff going, so all the people except these, perhaps, wanted to hear, oh, this is the way it should be, and now we're doing God's way. Now, don't change anything here. I mean, we don't take any chances about anything. And so the official prophets preach words of promising continuing prosperity and security if you don't monkey with anything. And this is the time, then, that Yahweh's Spirit led some of that remnant to begin to write down the early stories. This is the period of time that the Hebrew scriptures get written. And before that time, it's still the storyteller, passing on and on. And here's where they finally write it down so it can be kept. And even if no one lives it out, they still have the story that way. And the hope was that the people would get tired of what they were going through and want to go back to the old way. So the people of the other countries could see what's happening and join with them so that the vineyard would be filled with God and with others and with all creation. And one of the prophets during this time is Jeremiah, who was imprisoned and killed because he spoke out against all of this stuff. And he's the guy who, when they were going to be taken over by the people on the outside, the Babylonian invasion, he went and bought property as a testimony against the Babylonian invasion, that God would keep the promise and that someday this land would be ours again. But the people wouldn't listen to him, and then he was actually killed in that way, and then they end up at the waters of Babylon. They're taken out over to Babylon, and they see their own degradation, and God, hearing their cry in Babylon, decides to give them another exodus from Egypt. Here's that story again. Israel coming in, loving God, responding, and then falling away. God coming back, falling away. God coming back again and again. And everyone, the goal is again, now if we do it, and how God is patient and believes in these people. When, you know, there's no reason to believe that we can see, we believe them. God's still wanting everyone to know God intimately, the sins of the people being forgiven. That beautiful section in Jeremiah 31, Dan says it here, their God and God's partner people will start over. The people will renew the vows of the covenant promise. God will make a new covenant with Israel. The beautiful law of manna and mercy will be written on the hearts of the people. You won't have to look it up in your yearbook. Everyone will know God intimately, and the sins of the people will be forgiven. Manna will be shared by all, and the creation will live in, in shalom. It's at this time that Jeremiah writes about comfort, comfort ye my people, as he is telling them to wait on God. Even if you run away, God will take you back, and the remnant among the exiles hangs on for dear life. And this is when they wrote down more of the stories. Their stories of how the world began. The creation story comes from here. And the other stories of how they had lived through the wilderness experience. They get written to this time, down in this time. And they confessed, when they told these stories, they were confessing, we got to get back to the God who created the world in the first place, and who gave us everything, and who still gives us everything. That cycle of coming back again and again is the emphasis that all nations would be blessed out of that seed of Abraham and Sarah. Loads of pictures in it, like, comfort, comfort ye my people, and as a woman surrounds her child, and the people coming back to find out how it could be different. Jeremiah buying his land, people by the waters of Babylon here, and the rituals the people were going through, making them sick. This is the writers of Dan uses of biblical scholarly people down here writing them out, the letters of the people that are known for, what they're known for. This is the way the land is with the people on the inside, and the soldiers keeping the little deals out. They're back to the old picture of Egypt again. And the fight between the kings on either side. Dan writes it out in ways that I think makes it more interesting to listen to and to get acquainted with. So if you don't have one of your own, have your pastor, your church, get one for your library so you can read it too, because a lot of the fun of Dan's stuff is seeing his pictures as well, because that's the way he saw it, first of all, too. Sure, so, comments, questions, whatever.
Is it just Old Testament? Or is it...
No, it goes through all the way. No, it's the story of God, Dan says. It goes all the way through, up to the... We did the first now, about the first 8 chapters, and there's 8 more. And there's one more when they're home again, and then God's surprise, which is Jesus coming. And he goes into the New Testament.
Can that be used like in a neighborhood Bible study?
Oh, sure. Could be used in lots of ways. Sure. Very good. And he gives permission here even to copy. Individual pages and pictures in this booklet may be reproduced by churches, schools, nonprofit groups for one-time nonprofit use in bulletin newsletters and classroom study material. He doesn't want you to redo the book, because he put all the money into getting it out. He paid for that himself. So obviously that would be the only pair for you. Yeah.
And so he can pick things out of the book. We have copies, because there's different kinds of printing in it too. It catches your attention.
Yes.
So Your eye just skips around and picks up.
Right, yeah, it isn't.
The pictures are delightful.
I think they are.
If you want to pass.
I have.
If anybody has seen it, I'd be happy to share.
Do you want to see?
Sure.
Okay.
I like the continuity of it. So long, for so long, the Old Testament to me was a bunch of spotty stories and they had no connection. He connects everything from beginning to end.
That's really one of his gifts, I think.
And puts that central theme to you that you sometimes miss, and I have missed.
Yes.
You get confused in the many stories and the many words and the many personalities, and you don't follow that central theme like he picked up.
He has the thread keeps going, and that's important to understand. The Old Testament is the threads that go through it rather than the cut-up thing. That's one of our problems, and again, even in the New Testament, when we're reading the, I always call it, if you're going to say the Holy Gospel, the snippet of the Holy Gospel, that's what we should say. You know, it's just a little piece that we cut them all up. That's why last week I led the study of the Gospel of Mark. We read the whole book last week to try and pull it all together. To have things that make sense together rather than only snippets. And there are plenty of ways to do Bible study. There's not only one way. But I think we've been satisfied with snippets.
A favorite verse.
Yeah, right, yeah. I'll be kidding about that tonight. Yeah.
We bought two copies, obviously, the wife and I, because I immediately saw things that I could do over in the Philippines with this book.
Good. Very good. Some of his earlier books have been translated into Spanish and elsewhere.
They look good.
Somebody else?
I like the sense of humor in it.
Yes.
It has lots of humor and it's understandable to the. It's understandable.
Right.
It needs very little explaining. Mm-hmm. It's done in. It's kind of language and concepts that we understand. They modernize it because when you study the Bible, you think of things way back when, mm-hmm. when this is mm-hmm. real today. Right. And that's kind of important.
I think so too. And Dan would say, well, if I can understand it, then anybody can understand it. So,
yeah. And it's relative to us today because lots of times people will study the Bible and say, well, in those days it were different, but then. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's two little, I don't know, what are they? Are they chipmunks or mice or what? They come up every once in a while.
Well, I saw the first two, they had elves on, and I was thinking Minnesota gophers.
No, oh, right, yeah, they would be gophers, wouldn't they? That's what it was, yeah. And they come up and say things at the side, every once in a while. They make comments on the picture. Really clever. Yes, please.
Our little neighborhood group is the ecumenical group. Some of them don't really even know the Bible at all.
Mm-hmm.
And how would you suggest we do this? Just read it, and would we make up questions or review it?
It depends. If everybody's going to have the book, then by all means, they would read it. If not, I'd have somebody read it and tell the story, and maybe lift up one or two of the pictures from it, and then work out a couple of questions on each thing. Something that would occur to that person leading it, but then let them have some of their questions as well. I, like many people, I believe the people themselves have the questions, and if you're in a group over a period of time, you get comfortable enough with each other to finally, you know.
Comparing it with today would be a fun thing to do in a Bible study.
Mm-hmm.
Does this speak to us today, or how does it happen here?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Any similarities in our society?
Mm-hmm.
It just happens. We're starting with Moses this next week.
Oh, great.
He brings out, from what you've said, brings out this concept of what you've got drawn on the board there.
Uh-huh.
It seems to me that we're back in that position now, and he's saying, and of course we are, I think we all agree, that that's not what God intends. Does he offer in the book some concrete ways for us to break out of that? Now we can verbalize how this can be done. We just have to change. But does he offer some things then to help that process?
I think he has two reactions to that. One is that whenever that happens, it usually doesn't work. But that his contention is that like those people when they were in their worst situation, where everything was wrong, the point was to continually tell the story and continually believe the dream. And that then some people, you know, these remnants or whoever it is, something happens that brings it back again, because it all starts with God's stuff. He encourages everybody to take every one of their little steps. That you can't, you don't, God never imposes that on anything, any more than Jesus Christ did. He could stop the waves, he could remove the bread, but he couldn't make, he chose not to make anybody believe.
But God gave, he left symbols.
Sure. For,
and when your children ask you,
sure,
tell them what these things mean. When our children ask us, have we got those things in our lives to tell them what we're doing?
Oh, he would say that's the covenant. The symbol we have is the covenant. The symbol we have is manna. The symbol we have is the Exodus. The symbol we have are the commandments. And those are valid for those people all the way back and would be valid for us today. And the commandments are against this kind of living and for manna living. And whatever can make a piece of manna living in your home, with your neighbor, in our society, whatever it is, Dan would say, you know, he'd be much better at it. Those symbols are all here for us. We have to keep coming back to them. And the struggle that the remnant is always in is always a struggle. It's never easy to say, oh yeah, let's go do that. Doesn't work that way. People say, I'm not going to do that. You mean, you're going to take away my social security? You are not. Try preaching on social security sometime.
Yeah. Our hope is in remembering. Mm-hmm. Once we stop remembering, yeah, all things, right, are lost.
And expecting, yeah, the remembrance to make a difference.
I just bought, you know,
yeah,
Father Nowen's book on remembering.
Mm-hmm.
It's
good.
Mm-hmm.
Good book.
And that's an excellent insight.
Sure. Sure. Right.
He also, yes, tells us that we are not, he did not make people slaves.
Right.
And when people themselves make themselves, mm-hmm, slaves of whatever is evil,
sure,
he gives us free, still gives us free will.
Right. That he, that when people make slaves of other people, they make slaves of themselves as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's totally against what God had in mind for the human, excuse me, the humans, the human beings.
Yeah. And you'd be surprised at how that happens.
Oh, yes.
In very, not outwardly, but in very hidden ways.
Oh, absolutely. In families?
In families.
In friendships?
In
the church?
Mm-hmm.
Certainly in governments? Between nations,
oh, for sure.
Even in the workplace.
In the workplace, of course.
In the South, didn't they have something from the Bible that said it was okay to have slaves, didn't they? During the time, southeastern,
there are people who have had all kinds of things. They've had worship of sex and all claimed the Bible for that. There's all kinds of ways of thinking about life that people claim come from the Bible, sure. And people in the South did that, sure.
Yeah.
Whole denominations did. Which shows how wrong people can be. Sure. You can find all kinds of stuff to back up that. And that's, again, that goes back to the kind of Bible passage approach to it. Rather than this overall approach of what God is about, you take a little snippet here, and take a little snippet here, and you put all kinds of stuff together that way. Hi, you know, let me start with this, the story that was written during this period about Daniel and the lion's den. Now, if you know how the story ends, don't say so. How many of you do know how the story of Daniel and the lion's den ends? Okay, how does it end?
He has saved God has allowed a lion's den.
wrong. That's not how it ends. It ends that all the people who put him in were put in there and killed and wiped out. Slaughtered. We don't want that, so we snip it off. Scriptures tell us the whole story. And we clip it off. We want to make it all real and nice. No, I don't like that part of it. But see, that's how we do our snippet business. We cut around so it doesn't, get in there. I don't know why that's in there, but it is. And if you don't tell the whole story, you've chosen to make the story your own. You can tell the story of Christ then up to the cross and snip it off. You don't like the cross. I don't want that to happen,
Called human interpretation.
Sure, right. There's so much of it. And we're all in that boat. We're all. Dan Erlander is. Everybody. No, we can't be all hypocritical. But that's why the goal is constantly be talking with one another about it, on one hand, and then looking for the threads and streams that go all the way through, rather than little places to, where things occur, and then we use one little kind of a verse or several little verses to work things out. And that's a struggle. I said last night, I don't know of any way of thinking and talking about God where that word doesn't come in. Now, I don't mean to say it's bad. It's just that you're trying to put God in that marvelous dream together with people who have limited understanding and limited hopes and limited dreams. And how to keep those things come together, because we tear apart so much of the time. And that's the struggle I'm talking about. Again, not earning your way, but how difficult it is to, not difficult it is to love the people that are closest to you, which should be the marvelous thing in the world. You've got so much time and so much whatever, and there's the ones that can tick you off the worst. It's a strange business, but that's the way we humans work. You want to kick the children of Israel in the butt. Don't you remember? This was just how long ago? But you and I were there. Same way. Or the disciples, when we look back now and we know all the stories and how they're going to end, and we say, boy, are they dumb. We'd have done the same thing. And we do the same thing today. So it is that dependence on the mercy of God and the compassion of God. Boy, how that word comes through in here. How God... the word comes from wounds the people and brings them back inside again. Very strong language of how God hangs on and won't give up. Yes?
This is quite a new book, isn't it?
Last week.
Okay, so it hasn't had any chance to be criticized by...
Oh, no, my people will.
Sure. Book. Right. It's just a Bible coloring book, as I think he points out in it.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And it's kind of a summary which could be oversimplified.
Could be, but you'd have to do your homework to say so.
Yeah.
Because he's a good scholar.
There would be a lot of homework.
Yeah, because he's a good scholar, and there'll be people who read this and make their reevaluations of it, sure. Yeah. But he had about 7 theologians reading the manuscript for him, who had went through it. And he identifies the books where the things come from and encourages people to get the books and follow it up for themselves. So he doesn't consider it. And he'd be the last, if you know Dan earlier, he'd be the last one to say, well, that's absolute truth. He wouldn't say that.
Because it's new. Direction.
Pardon?
It's a new approach or direction.
Right. It's an effort to make that old story not stale, but alive and vintage. The vintage stuff comes through again, right?
You read that and say, oh!
Yeah, yeah. That will be useful. A, that you read it, and B, that you respond to it, for sure. And even if you would disagree with it, he'd be delighted, because at least you're reading and disagreeing with it and thinking about it, man, that would be great. Dan would be pleased, and certainly I would too, yeah.
I was glancing through the foreword, and it said that he was appalled at the biblical illiteracy in our culture, and I wondered if this book came about as a result of his working with college students.
No, I think he was working on it before that, but it certainly would fit. Oh, yeah. I don't think they have a corner on illiteracy.
No.
Biblical illiteracy, I mean, yeah.
But I think there is a lot of biblical illiteracy.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Well, I'll stick my neck out, because I think adult education is the major task of the church. And I think we have run from it like that. Oh, let's teach the children. Baloney. Teach the adults. And have the adults teach the children. We hopped on. We're scared of adults. They might disagree with us. Oh, dear. You know, who cares? As long as we're talking about the right stuff. Sure, stuff for children, sure. But we have played that game for so long. What's happened? Age 12, 14, they won't see ya. See ya. Mm-mm. People go to psychotherapists, not because of their pastors, very often, not because, certainly sometimes, because of their friends, but most of the time, because of their parents. That's, well, on one hand you say, well, isn't that terrible? On the other hand, you say, that's great. They're the ones who make the imprint. The time the parents spend with them is the impressive time. If that time is being creatively and consistently built on what is being revealed in images that will stay with them, sure, they might have trouble with them sometime or the other. And the way we do it could be wrong anytime, you know. I can give you a list of the mistakes that I know of that I made with my kids. I don't know all of them, but some that I do know, of course. But the worthwhile stuff comes from parents. And getting parents to believe that again, you know, would be just great. And equipping, I think church's task is to equip adults and parents to be with their children. But you're right, the literacy is all over the place, and certainly it is on campus. He doesn't teach on campus. I regret that. They have a religion department that's separate from a campus ministry. If I were in that religion department, I'd be using Lanterns. Somebody else. But that's a valid point about literacy, biblical literacy. Well, you can get in a group today, and then we know who Moses is, or Abraham, or whoever.
I think that could be true with the Jewish people themselves.
Oh, sure. Well, they're no different than anybody else.
Well, no, but we know that as a group, they're not worshiping in the synagogues and temples and so forth. Right. They're not, except on holy days and that kind of thing.
Like Sweden and Norway.
Yeah,
I
hate to hear that.
Absolutely.
Say no.
If we say it one place, we got to say it the other.
I'm
for sure.
Be true, so
absolutely. Sure.
Makes me so ashamed.
What else? Yes?
I just had the privilege of going through Teddy Roosevelt's National Park near Medora.
Oh.
And I think those little animals are South Dakota groundhog.
Oh, all right. They just got mixed up and put the M on, right? Yeah. misled South Dakota man. But I like it. Somebody else? Anybody else?
When you were talking about the different ways of saying for what the Jewish people say for Jesus.
Yeah, just Yahweh was the word I used.
Well, I happen to belong to or support a Jews for Jesus.
Oh, sure.
You probably have heard of them.
Sure.
Their headquarters, the first headquarters is in San Francisco.
I see.
And that's how they always refer to Jesus as Iowa. Their title is Jews for Jesus, because if they didn't have that, people wouldn't know what they were talking about.
Sure.
And it has established itself. It's really remarkable. They have... they're in South Africa, London.
Mm-hmm.
You heard of
really
remarkable.
Open the
door.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, You're welcome to come tomorrow night. We'll do two more, there's two more nights at 6:45.